serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Trailer for sale or rent, room to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes. About 2 hours of push and broom. Buzz a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means. King of the road.
That is our guest today, 92-year-old Larry Cosgrove, singing like he does every Wednesday and Friday night at Curly's in Signal Hill, California. King of the Road could have been his theme song while transporting tanks and other supplies with the 467th Ordnance Evacuation Company. You just heard some of his musical ability, but during World War II, he thought he'd have the chance to see one of the most famous musicians of the era, Glenn Miller, who rose to the rank of major in the Army Air Corps and performed hundreds of times for the troops in Europe. I know this story is kind of bittersweet, Larry, but tell me the story about Glenn Miller after the liberation of Paris.
Oh, yes, that was when we first got into Paris, and we had come up with that time it was a convoy, and we went to Vincennes. They were billeting soldiers at the Paris racetrack, and so they had all these horse stalls, and they just thrown some straw in there, and we had our own sleeping bags, so we were sleeping there. And somebody said, hey, Glenn Miller's supposed to be in doing a show in downtown Paris. So we got out of our drugging clothes and put on our Class A uniform, no tie, but everything else. We hopped the metro from Vincennes into downtown Paris. We got off the train and we walked up, asked somebody where the theater was, and they pointed out and at least gave us directions. And when we came to the square, there was a million GIs there, all wanting to get in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't even get close to it. And then a few days later, we found out that, I wonder what happened to that. And then somebody who'd gotten some news said, oh, Glenn Miller didn't show up. The band played, but Miller never was there. And then later on, we, you know, heard that the band flew in a C-47, but he came in a small plane and never got there.
And they've never found him.
Nope. Still don't know what happened there.
Still a mystery today.
It's like Amelia Earhart.
Yeah. Did that hit you hard? I mean, here's a guy, I'm sure you'd been listening to his music the whole time.
We think it's a real loss, both to the morale of being able to do the morale type stuff, but also, hey, that was one of our favorite band leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, before the war, before we came in the war, he was one of the most popular. Yeah, I think we were all pretty sad that we lost him. At early time, we didn't know he was lost. We just heard that he didn't show up.
Right.
And then we were off doing our stuff, and it wasn't until much later, one of the Stars and Stripes, they called the little newspaper that we got, and they were always way behind before they ever got to our units because we weren't attached to, you know, one big unit, so sometimes things like that came in slow.
Well, speaking of learning of things, do you remember when you first learned of the existence of these concentration camps and what was happening there?
No, that wasn't something that ever was made known until after the war. We knew that, you know, you'd read that before I went in the Army, that Nazis were persecuting the Jews and that they were many put in concentration camps. That was known to the world, I guess, before we got in the war. But we didn't know to what extent it was, and I didn't really read about that till after the war.
Pretty hard to fathom, isn't it?
Yes, just a little sideline, nothing to do with me, but my brother's brother-in-law, his unit were the first one to rescue Dachau, and he said it just made him sick. He says he threw up and he saw how horrible it was. But that's a sideline. It wasn't part of my experience.
It's the reality, and it's also true that your being over there and doing your job was part of an effort that finally closed those down and liberated the survivors that were left.
Yes.
Does that give you some satisfaction?
Well, it's the overall satisfaction of defeating the Germans. I think we all knew it was evil. We all knew that eventually it had to be destroyed. And that was one thing I think that gave us a lot of incentive, was we did have an objective. I can see today about Vietnam and Korea and people who were there and saying, you know, what are we doing? But we knew what we were doing.
So when VE Day came, was that pretty big news?
Guard duty up on a hill. I remember the sergeant of the guard came out and said, well, we're not going to have to go to Germany now. The Germans have surrendered. Yeah, we were happy. Because we were in line to be in the frontline combat. And if it had gone on another month, I'm sure I would have been up there in the front lines. But it just happened.
But it wasn't over yet for you, because the war's still going on the other side of the world.
They put me with a chemical processing company, and we had them in Europe, too. They were there, but in case the Germans used gas, any kind of chemical warfare, they would be there to treat the people and the equipment and whatever got contaminated. And so they sent me to Marseille, and I was there for probably 2 weeks, and then I got assigned to that company. They were just getting ready to get on the ship. They shipped us through the Panama Canal over to the Philippines, northern Luzon. We set up there, started getting all our equipment ready and moving it in, and we got the announcement that the atom bombs had been dropped. We didn't know what kind of bombs. They just said, hey, apparently we bombed several cities in Japan so heavily that they've now surrendered, so we're not going to have to invade Japan, which made us feel good. That was a relief.
Yeah, what do you think would have happened if those bombs didn't drop and in the invasion?
If we'd had to invade, the casualties on both sides would have been horrendous, because every issue we had where we were into their homeland, they fought to the death. At least that's what we were told. And the evidence since has proven it, even there in the Philippines, because there were still Japanese after Japan had surrendered that didn't even know they'd surrendered. So they
were up years.
In northern Luzon. Yeah, that went on a long time. They were still warning us, you know, don't go. We had no reason to go up there. We'd just be sightseeing. And they said, hey, that's an area you don't want to go. They brought us home according to point system. People that had more points, more battle stars. If you had a Purple Heart or a Silver Star or anything, you got points for those. Mm-hmm. Any award. I had 2 battle stars, and then how many months I'd been in the Army and how many months overseas. And so I got those points. But there were a lot of us. And they had no expectation that those bombs were going to be dropped. That was a total secret to most of the people in the Army, even at the top level.
Truman didn't even know about them until Roosevelt died.
Yeah.
So imagine that.
There was no preparation for, hey, we shipped all these guys over there. How are we going to get them home? So it took quite a while. So I was there from July or August, I guess, was when the Japanese surrendered. And it wasn't until January that they brought us home. So we just had to look busy.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, had the invasion gone forward, that there would have been astronomical casualties on both sides.
Yes.
Have you ever pondered whether you would have been one of them?
I never really thought about that. Would I have to do some combat-type service in Japan? And so it wasn't a thing that was surging in my mind as we sailed. We didn't know where we're going. And some people were saying, oh, they're taking us home. We're going to go to New York. It was all just guesswork.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until we got on the ship and the ship sailed out of Marseille. It was a big new troop transport, about 6,000 troops. After we got out of the Mediterranean, they said, now we're released to tell you where we're going.
Well, and I'm not trying to press you, and I'm not trying to point to a specific answer. I'm just interested in what you genuinely think. You've got a lot of years of reflection since then, and examination and learning. You've read about what the invasion would have looked like, that, you know, they estimated 1 million Americans and more than that on the Japanese end. So knowing all that you know now, what do you think? You think you would have survived an invasion of Japan?
Well, if they were looking for 1 million casualties, my luck would have been about a 50%, I guess, because I think there were about 2 million American soldiers in the Pacific theater. If half of them would go, it's a pretty good chance. But that's, you know, we were, I don't want to say happy-go-lucky, that wasn't the right thing, but most all of us had a very positive attitude about our chance of survival right from the very start. We knew we had a purpose. We have a target, and we're going to get it. Sooner or later, we have no doubt that America is America. we'll always win.
Larry's positive outlook hasn't changed much more than seven decades later. He did realize after a drafting class that engineering wasn't exactly his thing, but accounting sounded good. He became a CPA and rose through the ranks of Rockwell International in the aerospace industry. Just recently, he added another mission to his list, a trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southland. So what was that like, Larry? What were the highlights of your Honor Flight experience?
We started out with all those different memorials, and one that I was impressed by, the changing of the guard at Arlington and watching the precision and the absolute perfection of their movements, and when the officer of the day comes out and inspects the rifles and just how he really goes over them, thorough inspection. Then I thought, but they look like high school kids.
Well, and during World War II, you looked like a high school kid.
Yeah, well, I was.
Exactly.
Not much faster.
So when you went to that National World War II Memorial and you took that in, the pillars for every state,
yeah.
Storyboards for different
yeah.
battles, Battle of the Bulge right there, you remember.
Yeah.
And then the gold stars, 406,000 Americans who didn't come home like
yep.
you did. What kind of things went through your mind there? What were you thinking about or reflecting on?
Well, it brought back a lot of the memories. I was pointing out to my son, there's one big map there, and, you know, here's the places I went, and probably telling him more about my Army days during those 3 days than I did the rest of his life.
You don't say that lightly. That's
no.
You mean that.
No, I do mean that. It just, we came home and we didn't talk about it. Just happy that things worked out. We did our job. Those tanks had to get up to the front, or Patton wouldn't have been moving like he was. And all the other stuff we hauled up was necessary, and we performed a service and did the best job we could. And we're happy, for the most part. Most of the fellows were happy that they were able to serve. So that was it. And then when we got home, it was just unbelievable as we walked in. Fife and drum corps. Some kids, some young folks, several other musical groups, and people all along that are welcoming us home and just and blowing your mind. Wow. And as we come out there, everywhere cheering, and then they announced our name, and then everybody's cheering. Really, really getting your heart, you know, that people mm-hmm. care. You know, there are people that really honor us, even though, you know, they say, oh, look at the heroes. I'm not a hero. I mean, Audie Murphy was a hero. We just did what we had to do and made it. So it was quite a experience.
Did your eyes stay dry?
I was laughing all the time. Hey, how are you? Waving my thank you, thank you, thank you.
Uh-huh.
I was very happy that people seemed to care. That's what made us feel good.
Well, let me join the chorus and say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story.
You're welcome.
Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for at age 92?
I have 3 points that I'm come to my mind that I couldn't pass. I've got a daughter, Teresa. I have a son, Joseph, and I have a stepson, Paul. I'm blessed. My life, although I spend a lot of time at Toastmasters, I sing with a jazz band, I bowl, I do a lot of things, they're still the pillars of my life. Make it worthwhile.
How worthwhile it is. Larry Cosgrove, 92 years old. Catch him singing at Curly's on the corner of Cherry and Willow in Signal Hill, California, every Wednesday and Friday. Also, pull up the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com to hear the rest of Larry singing King of the Road, more of his stories from the war, and even some thoughts about Larry from his stepson, Paul Laufer, who recommended him for Hometown Heroes. That's the end of our radio time for today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.